I think it's fine.
That is Adrienne. I hope I'm pointing the right way.
I hope so too.
On my screen. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to TFOS, the Executive Function Online Summit. My name is Seth Perler, and we're here today with Adrienne Meltram, who I've known a long time. Adrienne has a website called Made for Math, and it is an extravaganza of online math tutoring and support. She's been doing this a long time. In fact, you don't need to know this, but I'm going to tell you. Adrienne literally helped me, I think it was 2016, start my first webinar and figure some of this stuff out.
For sure. Because
I absolutely positively had and have imposter syndrome. Shh, don't tell anybody. But imposter syndrome where, you know, when you don't know how to do something, you don't know what you don't know. And I didn't know how to do that. And she's just really good with a lot of tech stuff. We become good friends over the years. And hi, Adrienne.
Hi, it's good to be here.
She's a fantastic person who really brings a lot of heart to kids. And I've just seen her just develop how she serves humanity over the years. And it's been really cool to watch you.
Ah, same here. I've enjoyed watching your journey as well. It's been really, really fun.
So Adrienne, in that little intro, what else do you want people to know about you that I might've left out?
Well, I think it's important for parents to know I'm just like them. I've got three boys, and two out of the three have various executive function issues. That's why I know Seth. I needed Seth in my life. I needed several of the speakers that you're experiencing in this summit in my life because I couldn't do this by myself. I needed help. And it's so awesome that I have these tools now and I can hold space for my kids. And I think they feel seen, heard, and loved from the things I'm learning from you and the others that are here in the summit. So I'm just like you guys. I'm working at home. I'm working remotely. My kids are too. So I feel like we're all in the same boat together and that we're going to be good friends because of that. I've been there, done that, and I'm doing it right alongside with you every single day. So I think that's important to know that I bring that personal story to all of my work. And if it's a struggle for me and my family, I know it's a struggle for someone else as well.
And give them a bit about your background in math expertise. And
Yeah. So I've been teaching math for a very long time, since about 2000, I say. And last year I told a different story about that, but I would say I took it all online in about the same time Seth and I started working on this stuff together. In 2016, the tutoring had gotten so crazy in person that, you know, my husband Dave was like, something has to give because you're like tutoring on the side of football practice and like your kids need help. They need help, you know, more than these other people's kids. And so at that moment I was at a crossroads and I knew I needed to do something. And so to shift my work schedule, I went all online so that I could work with kids who are East Coast, that kind of stuff. At the same time, I was also using multisensory methods, which is a challenge to do in an online format, but I did not let that deter me. I wanted to figure out how to make it feel exactly the same as it does here sitting next to me as it does on the computer. And I've been successful in doing that. So if you fast forward to today, it started out with just me and the demand got so big that I run a team of 17 people that I've trained to do the same method. And our goal is to not turn people away. We know that what we're doing is so effective. We want to make it available to families, no matter where they live. They could be in a small mountain town or a big city. It doesn't matter because of the online component. And teaching online in this way is not easy. My teachers that work for me have all said it's like being a first-year teacher all over again because you're learning so many new things, new ways of thinking, new technology, but the result is fantastic. So that's kind of my background and my passion because I wholeheartedly believe this online environment can be just as effective as in person.
Excellent. Thank you. And Adrienne's been doing this online stuff again for a long time. So I'm really excited for you all. We're gonna focus a lot of time on here with some of the things that you parents are going to come up against with this online stuff and how to work with it. And we're also, if you're a teacher watching, because I know there's a lot of teachers in the audience, this you'll definitely want to check this one out. So what's your topic today?
So we're going to be talking about, my topic's really long, my formal topic, but really we're talking about surviving, but really thriving with remote learning this year as a family, as teachers. There's some key things that we can be doing that will make and break the experience this year that I would love to share. I'm using them. I learned a lot of them from Seth, but there's things I've developed on my own that have really helped my kids do better with remote learning. It's not bump-free. I'm not promising that, but it's less stressful because of these things that I'm going to share today.
And how do you, and you can go in a little more depth than, you can take a couple minutes if you want to, but for the parent who's really new, and you're coming from a math perspective, but for a parent who's really new to executive function, they just heard of it in the last couple of weeks and found the summit and they're like, what the heck is it? How would you define it to them?
So I think that's such a great question. So I'll use some terminology that's a little teachery, but then I'll explain it. So just FYI. So I believe that executive function at its heart is a couple of things at play working together inside your brain. One of them is your working memory, and I'll explain what that is in a minute. And then becoming a flexible thinker as well, so that you can carry out a plan and a goal that you've set for yourself. And this applies to all areas of life. It's not just math or anything like that. We use it all the time. And adults struggle with it. Kids struggle with it. We're no different than each other. So that's one of my pet peeves, is that we often think that adults have got this all figured out, but they really don't. We need to be using these techniques for all people in all ages. So working memory is how your brain is accessing information that you've stored away. You learn something and your brain stores it in a spot. And then the working memory goes and retrieves that information and brings it in, and it's holding it while you're using it. So like in a math term sense, that's like pulling your math facts out. You know, it's 2 + 2, and using that information to do something with it. And what's interesting with math facts is that addition and subtraction is stored in a mathematical side of your brain, but the multiplication and division is actually stored more in a language hemisphere, and your working memory is working overtime because you're treating it almost like a language thing instead. So it's really important that we give our kids some space to use that working memory and grace, because it's going to take a long time to master those kinds of things. And so just like with math, things take time to develop and over time. It's going to be the same for keeping your room clean, learning how to turn your homework in, how to work independently. It takes a long period of time to learn those skills. Working memory is a big part of that. And it's a skill that develops over time. It's not something that we can quickly fix with, you know, a medication or something like that. That's not how that works. You have to, it's like a muscle. You have to practice using it and figuring out how you best work and learn with it. So that's how I think of executive function. Is there anything you want to add to it, Seth?
Well, when I talk about working memory with executive function, I almost always use a math example. And I'll give you the one that I use, and parents, you can try this. And then, Adrienne, why don't you give me one that's either a little simpler or a little more complicated, whichever one you think illustrates it better. But when I do talks, I'll often say to the audience, okay, I'm going to give you a math problem. I always use the same numbers. What's 163 plus 52? Mm-hmm. And then you'll see people start to raise their hand. And so, Adrienne, what is 163 plus 52?
You're going to laugh, because when I'm feeling a little bit of anxiety, Seth. So guess what that does to all of your executive function?
Interrupts.
Shuts it down. So what do I want to do? I want to write it down and like really think through it. And a term that I just learned the other day, it was called inchworming. I'm going to inchworm my way through that, because I'm feeling anxiety in this moment. Excellent. And I think that's important to talk about, that if you're feeling any kind of anxiety, all of the things you know disappear. That's why if you're on a stage and you need to say something, you might fumble over your words because you're feeling that anxiety and your emotions have taken over. So I'm definitely in that stage.
Cool.
So that's one thing I would say.
And I love that, because when I ask people, what we find is that people do it very differently. The people who do it really quickly decompose numbers really quickly. Yeah. So they look at it like 150 plus 50 plus 10 plus 3 plus 2 to get 215. And then there are some people, when I ask the audience, it's remarkable how many people write it out like on a chalkboard in their head.
Yeah.
They go line by line, they carry the numbers and everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but working memory either way is how are we holding on to the 100, the 60, the 50, the 2, and the 3? And how, what are we doing? How do we hold on to that? The fact that it's addition. And exactly. So we're juggling those things, working memory, we're working on it and it stays in our memory. So what's a good math one you would throw out there?
I think that's a really good one. And the other thing too, I think you have to be aware of that person. So I'm highly visual. So it would have been helpful to have you hold up a card. And then I would have had a visual that I could have held on to in my mind, manipulate the numbers then. And that's important as well. If it's all verbal, it's unlikely I'm going to follow you, you know, and a lot of my students are that way too, because they're so highly visual. We got to have some sort of visual piece to help make that, you know, stick. The other thing too is when we do a working memory thing, same kind of thing, the decomposing. And so we actually have to explicitly teach it. We draw it out and show them how it works because they don't understand how it works. Right. And so another good one would be adding above 9. So we could do 17 plus 9. Okay. And so what we have to teach our students is to break that 9 down into numbers that are really helpful. So what could I break 9 into to make 17 bump up to the next rounded number to 20? That kind of stuff.
Gotcha.
So that's how I like to start with even more simple numbers. You picked a big one. You just like went for it.
I mean, I do. And I'm speaking to adults, and you know, you have a couple people in the audience that figure it out in like a fraction of a second.
Right.
The whole gamut.
Right. But I know there's parents in this group that are like, if they were probably in my same shoes, like, I don't know what the answer was. Right. But 17 plus 9, they probably still would need to get that piece of paper out and pencil, carry the one, you know, do all the things. So learning those strategies of decomposing really can help your brain release some of that working memory and work on what you're really trying to work on. And so that's what we try to do in our work every single day with our students. We do decomposing no matter if you're an algebra student or if you're a little kindergartner. It doesn't matter. Those skills are still used at both ages.
Cool. And my working memory just forgot where my brain was going to go.
I love it.
And that's why people say, So, all right. So I do want to say one more thing about the working memory in Adrienne's definition of executive function that I see a lot, particularly in higher level middle school math. And Adrienne, I'm sure you see the same thing. But what I see, parents, and you probably won't be surprised to know this, but kids who do calculate pretty well at a younger age, but who struggle with executive function and don't like details, once they start getting to an age where the teacher says you have to show your work, they're in 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, mm-hmm. and they know they don't have to show their work for the first year or so. I mean, they can do, they really can do 90% of it in their head. There comes a time when they can't.
Yep.
They cannot juggle that many details because there are so many. And the worst thing about that is that kids who could be taking really high level math appear to be not successful because of that working memory issue. Like, that's just reasonable working memory. Like, they just, you know, and it's sort of, they get into the stubbornness about, I can do it in my head, until they can.
Sure. Until they can.
They don't have the maturity to sort of see that.
Yes. And then they don't have the really good habits and procedures that really make and break that experience. And we're sticklers about that. But we have those hard conversations with our students. We tell them how it's being perceived and how your teachers are looking at you. And we know, and you know, and you know now, you can do this math, right? So we have ways that we get kids to write it out. We start with the more simple and show them how the steps work, right? And then we go more complex to show them why it's so important, because there becomes a point when you can't see the math anymore. You can't see it. And you have to rely on the procedure. And darn it, they do not like that answer. Yeah. It just feels way too tedious, but they're totally capable of doing that work.
Awesome. So let's go ahead and we'll dive into the meat of this and we'll really start exploring. Adrienne has 6 ideas for us today, but where we're going to start out, Adrienne, actually is talking a little bit about what multisensory is. We were talking with Wendy earlier today about sensory issues in general, but what in the world is multisensory math? Nobody knows except you. Just kidding. But why is that important? Because you're taking a different approach that helps people. We want to know about that.
Sure.
And then what's the A to B? You get someone brand new to you. They hire you guys and they're at point A. And the one who specifically for the summit who's struggling with executive function, what does that kiddo look like? You help them. They turn a corner at point B. It's not perfect, but they've turned a corner. Clearly, the parents are like, okay, things have changed. Thank you so much. We're in a much better place. Yep. We've absolutely turned that corner. What's A?
Mm-hmm. So what's A? Typically, a parent will notice a trend that, hey, you know, this isn't going so well. This math isn't going so well. And the other thing that'll happen a lot is the parent will sit with their child and they're helping them and it seems like they've got it. And then they go to school and they can't do it, can't perform it. And that is a problem, right? And they're just so frustrated and round in circles we go. Or they'll even hire some tutor. And again, they just keep going round in circles. They think the kid's got it. They don't, they go to school, blah, blah, blah. It all falls apart. So then they come to us, something different, right? So our approach is we take a lot of data on kids first. We learn, how do they learn? That's our first objective. And we're looking for the neural pathways. And so really we're looking at the language side of their brain, their procedures, so their executive function, okay? And then like, how do they do math? What's their process? How are they tackling this? And a lot of kids are visual, spatial, usually when they come to us. It's very rare that we have a kid that's got a really high procedure score. It's usually that their visual's off the chart and all the others are down. So we know, okay, multisensory is going to be great. So when we get them paired up with their teacher, the method we're using is we start with hands-on. Everything's hands-on. You get a box in the mail, you and your teacher have the exact same materials. And my team has been trained on how to show the student how to work with their materials. And the students have their little laptop and they know how to adjust the camera so that they can show their teacher what they're doing with their hands. So everything's really, really hands-on, especially if you're younger. But we'll do hands-on with older students as well. It's important. Then we start working them towards representational, which means just pictures of stuff. So you'll see a lot of digital manipulatives with us. We have some software that we love creating an interactive experience there. And then we move to the abstract, just numbers. A lot of teaching in school is just numbers. And some teachers think that they're giving that kind of support, the other two steps, but they're really not. And the piece that makes or breaks what we do is the language we use. Our language is so specific. And now students can understand what we're doing. And we really tie it to and tether to what they're learning at school. We use like Common Core to guide our instruction as well. So we make sure the student's keeping up with the grade level. We are honoring the age of that student, but we're also going backwards in time and plugging in those holes that are so important. And I think you and I have discussed this before. When you've got a bucket of knowledge and you've got a bunch of holes, it's important to plug them up. Otherwise, you're just losing everything that gets poured in the top. And so that's our goal. And so when families come to us, we start with that assessment. Then we mail you those materials and then you get started. And families will stay with us for at least a minimum of a year, but usually most of them don't want to leave. They love it here. They are so excited that their child's making progress. We've got one student who really doesn't need us, but she wants to stay. And she started with us when she was a seventh grader. And this is her senior year and she's taking AP statistics. Isn't that amazing? The little girl who came to me that said, I can't, now is taking an AP stats class. I mean, that speaks volumes to the method. And it's amazing, too, to watch how mathematics spilled over into her other subjects. And she's just a very good student now. All that confidence came from mathematics, which is really exciting. So that's at the heart of what we do. It's all hands-on, language-specific. It's a very unique experience.
Awesome. So I think that that's inspiring for parents to hear because I see a lot too. When we really slow down, less is more, really do math. I'm talking math in particular right now, but yeah. Math instruction aligned with executive function in a really conscientious way. What happens is that once we start filling those, and yeah, I use the bucket analogy all the time, but once we start plugging those holes, in other words, working with the gaps and the knowledge, and we do it right, it really has a great snowball effect. So you were going to talk about six ways. So again, Adrienne's been doing this a long time. Six things that parents can do to help support their child's executive function with the hybrid or online or whatever is going on. So what is number one thing that you wish they would do?
Yeah. So the first thing that always comes to my mind is keeping your expectations real. To expect that your child's going to sit down and work independently for 8 hours without bothering you is not going to happen. It's just not. And so you need to just give yourself space, a little bit of grace, that's how it's going to be. It's going to be an interrupted day in some ways. But there's some things I'm going to teach you that you can do to curb that. But I had a day, I think it was Monday. It was Tuesday. I had a day where it was full of interruptions and I was starting to get mad. And then I backed up and I'm like, okay, whoa, keep your expectations real. And so I messaged my team members and I said, hey, we're having a rough day with remote learning. I need to push these three things off of my schedule. I will get to them later tonight. And they, no problem. That's just fine. You know, that works for me. So I think it's important for us to keep our expectations real about what's going to happen, because there's going to be days where your kid's on point, they're doing good. And then you're going to have days where it's not going well and things are just falling apart. And so we got to be aware of those things. That's the reality that we're going to be in. Everyone this year is losing. There is no winning in this situation. Sending your child back to school causes someone else to lose, right? Keeping them at home causes you to lose in some ways. It's just how it's going to be. And I feel like if we can embrace that idea that we're all losing this year, we can get faster onto the path of winning at this remote learning as a family.
Yeah, it changes the frame and it lowers the stress. And then again, the less is more. We can hopefully, because what often happens in school and for these kids who struggle with executive function, they start to get behind, get more and more behind, more and more behind. So get the expectations real. There's going to be late work, missings or incompletes or zeros or days when they just can't rally or days when they're trying to listen to the teacher. They really don't know what in the world the teacher's saying. And since it's online, it's just the holes in the bucket are too much, and just having some empathy and compassion and patience and tolerance around that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So for you and your child, you know, like you're going to get mad, you're going to get frustrated, and that's okay. Like give yourself the space to do that, but maybe just don't do it in front of your kids. Don't blow up at your kids. Like they're doing the best they can and so are you.
And number two can definitely support number one and all of them probably.
For sure. So one of the things I would do is sit down and like create a schedule, but this requires you to do some work before. Don't involve your child super early. I would take the time and create some boundaries with the schedule. So you're going to have to dig into what are the expectations? What are the teachers wanting us to do? What's the school district wanting us to do? And take into consideration your work demands. Do you have some big projects at work? Do you have to be gone for work? That's reality for a lot of parents. What are those parameters? And sit down and make a long list of what needs to happen on your side, the school side, your child's side. Those are three things. Once you've kind of got a picture of that, then we want to find out if there's some expectations from each teacher specifically. So most schools will set like some parameters generally, right? And then the teachers might have very slightly different things that they want to do. But some teachers are awesome and they work in teams and, you know, they collaborate a lot to make it easier for families, but others don't. And so I know it can be overwhelming because you've got six or seven different places to look. So I want you to do that before you involve your child in the schedule making. Then once you've got all of those things done, you need to figure out and estimate how long do you think it'll take your child to accomplish these things each week. Ignore what the school's saying. If they're saying your child needs to spend 8 hours a day, the truth is you and I both know with the right focus and support, they could do it faster than that, right? And that's okay. Like just whatever you need to do to report on that, that's fine, because they by law have to report how many hours students are working. But keep in mind that however fast your student gets through it, that's okay too. That's a valid thing. As long as they're completing things and staying on top of the stuff, I don't see any problem with that. So kind of estimate that and be aware of what the pain point topics are. For my kids, it is anything English writing-based, reading-based. None of them want to do this. So I set that time of day aside in my schedule to support them with that because none of them want to do it. So I know that they're going to need a whole lot more hand-holding from me, but the other subjects they're a little more willing to do. So that's really, really helpful. And so go through the list. What can my child do independently? Mark which ones you know they're going to need help with. Then meet with your child and communicate together and create a schedule. It's a team effort. And if you get a willing participant on the schedule and what that looks like, you're going to get a much more compliant child. So my kids know that once they get their schoolwork done, they can do whatever they'd like during the day. So my youngest, he works very fast and efficiently in the morning because he's highly motivated to get that stuff done. But I've got others that kind of struggle along, limp along throughout the day, right? So we have to find other ways to get that motivation going. But it's helpful for them. They kind of know what the expectations are, and then we can create a schedule together of what that day looks like. And you want to put your needs in there. So if you have time that you need uninterrupted for work, if you're working at home, make sure your kids know from this time to this time, do not come into my office. If I have a sign on my door, don't come in my office unless someone's bleeding or throwing up or broken arm or whatever it is, so that you have a few moments to yourself where you can do some clear thinking, because that's really difficult too when you're all home working remotely. Someone on my team made a cute poster of that for her wall so that people wouldn't interrupt her sessions. And that was really effective. And so your kids just need to know what the boundaries are. You work together to create that schedule and put times in there where you're moving. We should be moving every 40 to 50 minutes. You don't want your child sitting in the same position for hours on end. That's not good for them. It's not good for you either. So put those breaks in there. I know a family that put in dance breaks into their remote learning schedule, and they blast the music, right, and get out their socks and run around and dance together and get their heart beat up, and then they get back to work. So there's some things you can do to help make that schedule a little more flexible for your child and support their needs as a learner. And then I would say the last thing I would do is go through if-then situations. If mom's on a call and you need help, you know, what could you do? Like brainstorm some of those scenarios, because they do happen. And Seth, you've seen my kids walking by sometimes. Today they were threatened, like, do not walk past that wall, right? I'm in a meeting, a super important meeting. So it's important to set those parameters with the if-then and help them brainstorm. How can they be aware of what their parent is doing, right? And support the goals of the family to get the remote learning done. And so they know when I hang up here with you, I'm available now. They can interrupt me. They can get help with their homework, whatever they need. And so that's a big overview of how you want to do the schedule. What we did at my house is we posted it where everyone could see it, right? And we're in the transition process right now. We're moving from a rental to a new house. And so I'm planning to get like a big magnet board to make it easy for me to move the schedule around according to what we're doing. But it's helpful too to have a morning meeting where you go over what's happening during the day. Let your kids know of like weird things that are happening in the schedule that might change what's happening. But having a schedule like school will be really helpful. And if you have a kiddo that gets overwhelmed quickly with long lists, only show half of the schedule for the day up to lunchtime. Then put the second schedule up so they can see in chunk bite times of what's going to be expected during the day. And then the last thing I would say for you, parents, if you work outside of the home and you've got kids at home that need to do school, you are in a very tough spot. And I think it's important for you to go back to the schools and advocate for what you need. So maybe that's longer periods of time to get the work done. Maybe you get Monday to Sunday to finish the stuff with your children. Maybe you get permission from the school to complete certain assignments, but maybe not all of them because we have limited time, right? Or you could go to your employer and say, hey, my kids are at home. Can I have an adjusted work schedule that allows me to work starting a little later in the day, like at noon, and I finish, you know, closer to 6 or 7 at night? Something along those lines so that you have a chunk of time to help your child with school, because having them do it independently, again, is an unreal expectation. It's not going to happen, right? And I think so many of us are feeling like, but I didn't sign up to be the teacher. But sadly, that's the reality this year. We're going to help and support our students and be the teacher in a lot of ways.
Excellent. And again, yeah, less is more. You know, just do what little you can and connect and smile with your kid and have fun and make the best of it. They'll be okay.
They're going to be okay.
A bizarre year.
It's a bizarre year.
So number one was keep your expectations real. Number two was about scheduling. And number three is about supporting them in the remote work. Meanwhile, with Adrienne's number two, she had like 7 points, and those are in the implementation resource. If you're getting the all access pass, it's all there if you want that. On number three, you're talking about supporting them in their remote work. How do we support them in this remote work?
Yes, I think there's two terms that we should be aware of that's happening. So there's this idea called asynchronous and synchronous learning. So asynchronous means you're doing it without your teacher, without help. It's on your own terms whenever you need to. Synchronous means we're doing it in real time. So like the work I do at Made for Math would be considered synchronous. We're meeting at a specified time. We're working on a specific topic. That's synchronous. So it's helpful to know the difference between those two things. Sometimes in education, we throw those terms around thinking a parent knows what that means. They don't necessarily know what that means. So
asynchronous is a term in the gifted world, not to be confused with a completely different meaning. And so forget that in terms of what Adrienne's saying right now.
Yes, we're talking about, yeah, the remote learning piece. So then with the asynchronous learning, so this is your child working independently. We've got a lot of that happening right now, which is not a bad thing. That's okay. So one thing you need to know about supporting your child with that is organize the schedule in such a way that we're having them work on their strengths for extended periods of time, the subjects they really like. So I've got a kiddo that loves math and science, right? He loves those. And then again, marking your schedule on like during the day when you can help them with the subjects they don't like. So English, social studies. is another one that brings a lot of tears our way. It's a lot of heavy reading. My youngest has dyslexia, so it's a lot of reading for him and it's overwhelming. So I need to be available to help him with those things. So we want to give our children a clear message that when you're opening your asynchronous or your work, whatever needs to get done, some teachers are sending a PDF or they're having them go to Google Classroom or they're having them go to, is it Canvas? Canvas. Canva? I think it's Canvas.
Canvas.
Okay. They're having them go there, right? And get their work and get that stuff done. If your child does not understand what the instructions are asking them to do within 10, no longer than 20 minutes, don't let the emotions get to the point where they're like crying and they're mad and they want to throw that laptop out the window. We don't want that. So after 10 minutes of struggling, teach them how to email their teachers and ask for help and clarity. And it's really helpful for you to take the time to write it the first time. Show them what you're doing. Maybe even take the time to create a template. And I can provide a tutorial too, Seth, for parents that maybe don't know how to do that in their inbox. So that when your child's struggling, they just know to click this template button and the email pops up and they fill in the blanks. Your kids know how to fill in the blanks, right? So that is really helpful. Then the child can list out, like, I don't understand this or this. Can you help me, right? There's really specific, we want to keep it short, to the point, and ask for clarity. The other thing I taught my children to do this year was take screenshots of what they're talking about and put it in the email. And that's helpful because A, it tells the teacher you care and you're trying. And B, it helps your child communicate clearly and effectively. Instead of just sending this email like, I don't get it. You know, teachers hate that. They don't want to hear, I don't get it. You don't get what, buddy? Like, tell me a little bit more, right? So the email helps them communicate in a way that allows your teacher to answer it when they have time, but also understand what they're asking. And so my children have been doing that this week. Sometimes they get prompt responses, sometimes they don't. So then I have to coach them through. If your teacher's not responding, you hit reply again to the message you send and ask, did you see my message? Right? You be kind as much as possible. So that's really important to have your children learn that. And I can't think of a better life skill than to learn to advocate for yourself and ask for help than that. And this is a great year to learn it inside and out. So no more than 10 minutes of struggle, max 20, then email that teacher. And if the teacher's hearing from enough parents, enough children, they don't understand the assignment, the teacher gets a chance again to try again to explain it better for everyone to benefit. And then you want to have your child also copy you on the message so that you're seeing that it's happening, that there's an issue, all of that. So that'll be good because the teacher will usually hit reply all and share what needs to be said. Another idea that I grabbed this one from someone on my team, Sherry on my team set up a workstation next to her work desk, and her husband's upstairs at his work desk and he has another child. And then they have one that can work independently. So the kids are sitting next to a parent, and if they absolutely need something, right, they're within close reach. The child doesn't have to get flustered and overwhelmed super quickly because mom or dad is right there to help. And so that's helpful, a little workstation. And then use earbuds to help keep noise and distraction between the two of you down, which is really hard. I get annoyed by like smacking lips or chewing chips or any of that. So earbuds are really, really helpful. So the other piece with that, when you're working asynchronously, set a timer for your kiddos. Have them work on it for 20 minutes. And then when the timer goes off, they can get up, go have a break, run around, whatever they need to do to have that little break. Because they're getting breaks at school, you know, they're getting up to get a drink. They're going to their backpack. You have to remember that they need those breaks too. So it's important to put those in there, lots and lots of breaks. And then also give your employer a heads up about how many children you have at home remote learning. I feel for some of my friends that have 5, 6 children at home, you guys have got to communicate it to your employer that you have a lot going on. And just FYI, I think it's important. Employers are being sympathetic. And I haven't heard very many stories of where they're not understanding. I think everyone is in the same boat. This is a rare time in history in that case. So let them know that, like, sometimes I might need to stop what I'm doing and help this child with this homework that they've got to get done. And then make sure you're putting that time in your schedule to help with the most difficult subjects and save them from a time of day when you're going to have a little more patience and a little more time that's uninterrupted on your schedule to help them with those subjects. So those are kind of my tips for asynchronous. When you're working with your child, I actually find that it's best to be shoulder to shoulder, not like sitting across from each other. Sometimes the way you gaze at your child can send the wrong message, especially when you turn 11, because your brain, when you're 11, starts reading facial expressions incorrectly. You're either happy or you're mad. And so they're reading them wrong. And so you might be feeling confused, right? You're doing a math problem, you're trying to add something, you're thinking, I haven't done this in forever. And so you're furrow your eyebrow trying to remember, and your child thinks you're angry at them. And that's not true, right? You're not mad, you're just trying to figure out the problem. And so to keep emotions down, sit shoulder to shoulder so you're not necessarily dealing with your child reading your face, and that way you can make whatever faces you want about the math homework. And that way you're a little more successful and they can communicate better. Shoulder to shoulder is one of my favorite things. And that works for anything besides work. If you're having a hard conversation, sometimes sitting shoulder to shoulder, the message is better received because they're not analyzing your face for something you're not intending to communicate. So those are some of my tips for asynchronous.
Okay, so let's hear about the synchronous. I don't have any comments on the asynchronous yet. Okay. I have a couple on the synchronous, but go ahead. What are
synchronous learning? So synchronous is that real-time learning, right? The stuff I do, the stuff you do when you're working with students. There's a lot of great examples out there of how it could look, and it's possible. So teachers, if you're watching, it's possible. Is it easy? Not at first, but it gets easier. So some great examples I can think of that you could go check out on the interwebs is Mr. Greg of Kindergarten Smorgasbord. He made kindergarten so much fun, and he live casted his first day so other teachers could see how it's done. Then there's Michelle at Harmony Learning Preschool. You're thinking, online preschool? Are you kidding me? Like, how does that work? No joke, my friend figured it out. It's like Blue's Clues 3.0 for preschoolers. It's the funnest thing, and she does it all via Zoom. It's the most amazing thing. My team's a really good example of that, about using document cameras. Less is more, again, when you're displaying something on the screen and keeping it short and snappy, and lots of images, and keeping your energy up. If you start getting tired and drained, the kids are going to feel that, and the whole session will go down. And then we like to keep it, you know, as moving as fast as we can so that it naturally holds the presentation, the presenter and the student's attention longer. And one thing that I'll say about that is, I think a lot of us have had those experiences where you're at a presentation and the person has just tons and tons of words on their slides, and they're just reading you their slides. Those are the most boring presentations for adults and children. No one wants to listen to those. And so when I was in grad school, I wanted to buck against that. I was in a twice exceptional grad school program, and a lot of people commented that my presentations always held their attention because I made sure we were changing slides about every 30 seconds. That maintains the brain's attention. Just like why we can watch a movie for 2 hours, it's because if you count between every 1 to 5 seconds, the camera view changes, keeps your brain on its toes. And so you should have lots of slides when you're doing a synchronous learning experience with a student. If you're gonna use slides, make sure there's lots of pictures, but cut the clutter, not too much on a page.
I'm making an example for you, so keep going.
Are you? Okay. So those are the things I wanted to share about the synchronous part, the real-time learning, is it can be really, really fun. What else do you want to cover on that, or should I move on to the
advocating piece? With the synchronous, yeah, like you said, the energy, like be there. And you don't have to have anything fancy. I use this cheap whiteboard, and we'll put my head to the side here, but I can see how I'm holding it up to the kid. So I definitely will. And so I do that. And then these pads of paper, I like a lot, or even sticky notes, but I can literally just like be like, okay, let me write it out for you. Can you read that to me correctly? How would that sound? So Adrian, can you read that to me? How, what if you were the teacher?
39x minus 5 equals negative 3.
That was absolutely perfect. And then I would compliment the heck out of you. And the other thing that I do a lot when I'm doing the online is I say, okay, I'm going to teach you something, but I'm going to quiz you right after. So I'd say, Adrian, I'm going to tell you that the FOIL method has 4 things. First, outer, inner, last. And I'm going to ask you what those things are in just a moment. You ready?
Yeah.
So they are first, outer, inner, last. Adrian, what were they?
Yeah. Right.
So I do a lot of cueing like that so that they know what's coming. And I feel like online with the synchronous stuff, you need to do a lot more of here's what's coming. Here's where I want your mind to be.
Yeah. And it's helpful to actually put the schedule out for what we're going to do during this hour. Okay. Or whatever, however long it is, putting it out on the side and marking where you're at.
That's a great example. In fact, Adrian and I are using a document right now that has the notes for this, and we're both looking at it on our computers. And I do this with students a lot. I open up a document for each student. In this case, the teachers might open it for their class, and I will look at it with the student live with their individual notes or whatever. So I don't know if that helps parents out there with the synchronous stuff. But
That's great. So then the fourth thing we'll talk about is the self-advocating. Again, that's like emailing, asking for clarity, create that email template, teach your child how to take a screenshot. That is like the best skill to learn. But there's moments when they might still be struggling. That's totally expected, right? So what you do at that point, you as the parent, email the teacher and say, hey, Johnny really struggles with writing. And I think a lot of you probably have a child that struggles with writing. It's the highest level of executive function we can do. Okay. So Johnny really struggles with writing. However, he loves making podcasts or he likes making videos. Is there a chance I could have him make one of those two for this assignment to show what he knows instead of a 5-page paper, blah, blah, blah. So advocate for your child to do something different. You can ask for a shorter assignment, less problems. You could ask for more time to complete work instead of having to have everything turned on Friday. Could it be on Sunday instead so that we have more time to work together? And then ask for an adjusted schedule that helps you as a parent. So whatever you can do, don't be afraid to ask. Teachers want you to be successful. They really do. I promise you, they don't want to be this stick in the mud that just wants to punish your child or whatever. Everyone's scrambling to make sure kids can learn this year. So ask for it. It doesn't hurt. Just give it a try if your child's still struggling. And then you can use technology too if you're advocating.
That was awesome, by the
way. Thank you.
Yeah.
So the fifth one that we'll do is talking about that technology piece. And I'm not going to spend a ton of time on this because you should have access to some of my tutorial videos on how to do this with your child, because I'm going to be mentioning some things that you maybe have never heard about, but they are huge and really helpful. One of the most powerful questions we can teach a child to ask a teacher is, will you watch me work this problem and tell me where I'm going wrong? Because a lot of kids want to say, I don't know what I'm doing wrong, right? They don't know how to say it. But if a teacher can watch the child work the problem, they can identify where they went wrong. And this isn't just for math. It could be anything. It could be, watch me make this sentence. What am I doing wrong? Watch me put this paper together. What am I doing wrong? You know, what am I missing here? I'm not sure I understand. And that's difficult because if your child can't make it to office hours, you know, a lot of teachers have office hours. You want to teach your child how to use technology to ask that very empowering question. So we're going to be using like screen recording software. And thank goodness there's companies like Loom who've made it so easy. You click two buttons and you're recording your screen. It's really fast. And then it generates the video quickly. You don't have to wait for it to encode or anything like that. Send it off to the teacher. Cool thing too is you get a notification that person watched the video. So then you can follow up with the teacher if you're seeing they're not watching it, right? You can remind them gently to watch this video. So there's cool stuff out there like Loom. Even your phone, your iPhone, can record your screen. I'm sure Android has similar capabilities. So I have a whiteboard app on my phone, and if my child's struggling, he'll do the problem on here. He's recording it, send it to his teacher. And that way, everyone's kind of seeing what's happening. The teacher can watch it a couple of times and then give the correct feedback. So using that technology to help you advocate can be huge. So there's a few tutorials that you should check out if you want to learn how to do it. It's very easy to do. I taught Seth how to use Loom forever ago, right? Yeah,
I resisted awesome. For like 2 years and now I use it all the time. Loom is excellent. Time. And if you click learn more on Adrienne, she put some extra videos on there. For everyone for free to check out that show you how to do some of these things.
Absolutely. So the last thing to do is to get some help. Get some help. Because, I mean, we listed out a ton of stuff, probably like 30 or 40 different things you could do. That's a lot. And I get that you're busy and I'm busy. So you could get some help and hire a tutor. Parents are doing pods. And Don't get this notion that there's only one right way of doing a pod. No, you can do a pod in a lot of different ways. Maybe there's other parents. You guys take turns each day who's supporting kids, you know, that kind of stuff. So you could do something like that. You could hire a private teacher, which is astronomically expensive, but it can be done to the tune of $75,000 to $90,000 a year. But if you have that kind of cash, you could do it this year. And then you could hire people like Seth. You could hire people like me. Several of the people speaking this year provide services like this. And again, our goal at Made for Math is not to turn you away. If you do get put on our wait list, we don't want you there longer than a month. But our goal is to help you. So like this year, we've got like homeschool classes. So you could do what's called dual enrollment, meaning your child's still part of their school, but we're their math teacher, so that they can have a break from being taught the way they're taught math, right? And have that year to get caught up to their peers. So there's those kinds of options, but you can also get some individualized attention for your children. And so we've got lots of families coming to us. We have some families that are finding a group of friends that are all in the same class and bringing them to us. So there's lots of ways to do this year, and getting help is definitely on that list. I've got people picked out for English and writing on my side that I'm going to be hiring to help us this year. So those are my tips, and that was a lot to cram in, but we're here to help you. Feel free to message me. I'd be happy to help you and kind of formulate that plan, because this is overwhelming.
Okay, cool. Three more questions. So yeah. This week, what's after the dust has settled from the summit, parents are already overwhelmed. What is one specific thing parents can do to take positive action with some of these ideas?
I would start with that scheduling piece. put in your calendar an hour to kind of learn what's going on at the school level, what is the expectation, and then start figuring out how you're going to mold it in and start communicating early with the school about what's realistic for your family, because it might not be the same for everybody. So there's schools out there that want you to check in every hour. If that's not going to work for you, start communicating it now. So take the time to look over the expectation. That's what I would want you to start with.
Some are doing it twice a class.
Twice a class?
Yeah. So
I don't think they realize what they're asking.
Well, the this is like the most shook up jar of mud you've ever seen.
It is.
Take a while to settle out. So you've been getting a lot of emails, phone calls, questions, concerns, things from people about what's going to happen this fall. What's one of the most common pandemic-y questions or concerns you've been hearing, and what's your gut reaction you want to share with people?
Oh, there's so many. And I wouldn't say that they all fall clearly like into this pattern, because everyone has very specific panic moments. But one common thing that people have been worried about with us in particular is like, well, if we pick you, does it even count? Right? Is any of this going to count against us or hurt us or whatever? And I've always said, like, if you can stay with your school, like do what you can and just get someone to help and support. That's what you need to do. And we can help supplement, right? And that way we're supporting the schools. We're not defunding them. We're not taking away their funding. We're staying on board and helping them. And so that's what I'm encouraging our families to do, to have us completely replace their schooling. We're math. We're not doing other subjects, right? And so those are some of the things that I think parents are worrying about. Like, if I get outside help, does it even count, right? And it counts, yes, because we're going to help you be successful at what you're being asked to do at the school level. So those are what some of the main concerns we hear. But in general, everyone's just in a panic. No one really knows exactly what's going to happen. School boards keep pushing out the decision too. I don't know if you're hearing that, but everyone's kind of delaying it. Yeah, it's really frustrating because people, I think, could get on board if they knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. The uncertainty is really, I mean, it's something that our kids struggle with. If there's uncertainty, it's stressful. We all are feeling lots of uncertainty. So in conclusion, forget Seth is even here. For the parent who's watching and they're really here at TFOS and they're really seeking answers, what's your heartfelt message from your heart straight to theirs? What's the most important thing you hope they walk away with right now?
I want them to take a deep breath, really, because I think there's this message that, you know, it's too late. It's too late. We've missed the boat with so many things. And I'm here to tell you, it's never too late to learn, to get what you need. And this might be your year that you get your child what they need. But if it doesn't fall into place, it's okay. There will always be time for you. We have time on our side. We've got students who come to us that are older. We're talking 18, 19, learning at a first grade level. That's young, right? That's where their mind is. However, it's not too late. Let's not give up. This child is making progress. So he's technically an adult, right? Making progress. There's always time to learn these skills. And you need to work on just loving your child where they're at. Meet them where they're at. I think that is one of the biggest gifts we can give our children, is see them, love them, and just embrace where they're at right now developmentally, because it's asynchronous. There's the 2E relationship. It's asynchronous. They might be really developed in this one area, but way behind in their executive function or something else. And that's okay. There's time to get them more leveled out. And that's okay. And so I want you to feel like you're seen and heard too as a parent. Seth and I have been here. We're living our truths right now. And we want to help you. We want you to feel that you have us as a coach, as a mentor, to help your child live their best life.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Adrienne. I really appreciate you.
You too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. All right, parents, good luck. Go check out the next one. And I hope you guys are doing great. See you soon. Take care.